Succession number 10602, Reel 8.
Could you tell me what sort of things you did on a tactical exercise? What sort of form of exercise it was?
Well, we would dig in, depending on the exercises generally, but we would dig in a section weapon slits, if you would like to call them modern time, but we would call them trenches. It would be short trenches which would contain a section, and you would get command that the Royal Artillery would be giving you cover and fire, a barrage. You maybe have some tanks hanging around, and then you would be given an objective, say an old building or an area of moorland to attack, which would be army property, government property, and you would just attack it, and you would carry out maybe one platoon at a time, or a section at a time, or a battalion at a time, depending on the size of the formation which was taking part in the exercises.
In any of the exercises that you did you see any sort of evidence of the sort of war that was fought in the Great War? Did they have a lot of trenches, for example?
Just a few small ones, not the long miles upon miles of trenches there were in the First World War. No, there wasn't any of those. Well, in the first place, you couldn't have had it, not in this country, because you'd have had to go into private property, and that would not have been permitted.
No.
They didn't mind you going through the crops, because they claimed, but they wouldn't let you dig the land up, I don't think. Not for miles.
No. I just wondered, did you practice things like trench raids and all that?
Oh, yes, you did that. You'd have some of your own battalion when you did your battalion training. You might have one company dug in one area and the other company attacking it, or the other three companies attacking it, or two companies attacking with machine gun support, or two companies attacking one company with the company having the machine gun support. You know, that was battalion training, company and battalion training. And then that would be on an enlarged scale when you went into brigade training with other units. You see, it would all start from small, but it'd be the same thing extended.
Yes, yes. Did you have any exercises where you had another unit fighting, as it were, against you?
Oh, yes, that's what I mean, you see. You could have one brigade fighting or defending against two brigades, if it was a division. You see, in a division there would be four infantry brigades. So you could maybe one have an infantry brigade with support, say, Royal Artillery or machine guns, and the other three brigades attacking it. And then you would have officers who were umpires stating, you know, you've been killed, or you've been wounded, or you've been completely wiped out, and you just lay, you know, you're finished. You didn't take any more part in it.
Oh, yeah, that happening to you?
Oh, yes, I've been put out of action, and I've had another umpire come up and say, oh, come on, you can't lie about, and you get on again, you see. But to keep the exercise going, really.
I was going to ask you, if you had been killed, what part would you play in the exercise from then on?
Well, you would lie around for a while, and then you would be told, all right, you're back to normal again, and get cracking. Or the exercise would end, and the umpires would decide, or the general staff, or the staff there, would decide who had succeeded. The ordinary soldier never ever got to know. You know, he wasn't told, well, we've done well today, we've won this war today, or we've lost this war today. You never got to know, you just did it. And that's why most soldiers didn't take it serious. For the first place, there was no live ammunition. It was blanks and thunder flashes. You know, if they wanted to class it as a grenade raid, they would throw thunder flashes. You might have some smoke grenades, mind. They might put smoke up, but there was no live ammunition used. The only live ammunition was used when you undertook your annual course on the ranges, and that was under strict supervision.
Well, actually, we could now move on to that. Could you tell me about the rifle ranges and what happened there?
Well, you had to qualify as a first class and a second class. You could either be a first class rifleman and a second class machine light machine gunner, that was a Lewis gunner, or a first class Lewis gunner and a second class rifle, to receive your efficiency pay. If you got your second certificate of education, you got threepence a day. They never took that off you. After a year, you got threepence a day on military efficiency pay. After 3 years, that could go up to 3 shillings. Now, the maximum soldier could get then was 3 shillings a day. But he must have his second certificate of education to get that. Now, he'd be tested annually on his weapons and his physical fitness.
What tests were given related to the weapon? What sort of things did you have to do?
200 yards, 300 yards, 400 yards, 500 yards, 600 yards with a rifle. Snap targets at 200 yards. And I think about 400 yards with a machine gun. And you qualified. Your own troops would be in the butts and they would signal scores up and the person supervising would count those scores. And there would be an officer in the butts taking the scores for every target. So there was no way you could fiddle a score. If you didn't score, you didn't get a score. If you scored, you got the score.
Can you remember what type of shot you were?
I never lost my efficiency pay, so I must have been a first with one and a second with the other. I know at one time I had the highest score in the company for rapid fire. That was 15 rounds in a minute. I only lost 2 points out of the 15 rounds. But that was the one and only time in the whole of my service that it happened. It must have been a fluke, but it happened that once. But other times, yes, I would think I was reasonable with the rifle. I was never happy with the Lewis gun. It was too much vibration with the Lewis gun, and it was too prone to too many faults. It wasn't a good weapon. It wasn't in the same league as a Bren gun, but it might have been a better weapon than the Bren gun in a frontal attack by the enemy.
Why was that?
Because of its distribution. You see, a Bren gun, as when you fire a Bren gun, you can put a magazine into a very small area, but with the Lewis gun, the vibration, you couldn't put two rounds within maybe a couple of feet of each other, never mind a group.
It's when you said you had to practice on a Lewis gun on the firing range. How did they measure your success at shooting it? Was the targets to aim at with it?
Oh yes, the targets was there and you aimed at the targets and there were scores. Scoring areas. And each round that hit the target was a score. If you hit the line, you got the higher score. You know, say you had the bull, then the inner and the outer. Whichever line you marked was the line you got. That was the higher score. Because if you would been hit on the skin, you'd been hit. You see, it wasn't the lower one, you'd been hit on the higher one. So you'd been hit. So you got the score. That do fair that way. But a Lewis gun target was a 6 foot target wide and 4 feet high. And sometimes it's difficult to qualify because of the vibration of the Lewis gun.
How many rounds were you allowed to fire?
Not quite sure. You'd be given so many rounds for the rifle, and so maybe one magazine or two magazines for the Lewis gun. Maybe one magazine containing, I forget now, it was a round drum and used to feed from the top as you used to squeeze the trigger. And you aim and squeeze, you used to do it in bursts, short bursts, because we kept firing all the time, you would fail.
Why was that?
Distribution. You see, as soon as it kept going, it was vibrating and it would go all over.
You'd just miss the target altogether.
You'd miss the target or you'd go over because you couldn't control the firing. If you could group in about four or five rounds at a time, but then you only had a certain length of time to fire that drum, so you were tied two ways, both by time and by mechanical failure. And that did happen. Mechanical failure would happen. Sometimes the officer on the target area would let you have another go if it was a mechanical failure, but some wouldn't. That's where the inconsistency sometimes came in. I can give a clear one of that twice, which happened in my service, once in the Sudan and once at after we came home, after service overseas. It happened twice.
What, concerning using the Lewis gun?
No, just using weapons in particular circumstances.
Well, can you, we'd like to give examples of that.
Well, we were in the Sudan in 1937, and we had to fire our annual course, and a sandstorm came up, and the officer made us fire the course in the sandstorm. And we couldn't use our rifles because the sand got into the bolt action and just seized them, every weapon up. And then we came back to camp because we couldn't fire. And then our company commander failed us all.
Did that mean you lost money then?
Well, we would have done if the CO hadn't been sensible. And the CO turned around and said that couldn't happen. He said it was daft. And our company commander said that wartime conditions would come that way. But then our company commander, the CO turned around and said, yes, but if this was wartime, he says, none of these men would need to practice. He said they'll already be trained, and they'll be, he said they would be firing at bodies. He said they would be firing at the enemy, they wouldn't be firing at sand. And the CO that time kept it. Now, when we came home, 38, I was Stony Castle Rangers near Bisley, and we were firing a course there. And we had to fire the Bren gun course with the Lewis gun. Now, the Bren gun target was 18 inches wide, and I think it was about 5 or 6 feet tall. It was a silhouette target, CU, in silhouette. That was the target we had to fire with the Lewis gun. And it was completely an absolute farce to fire a Bren gun course with a Lewis gun. And every man in the battalion failed. And the CO, he said, well, I can't understand it. And the brigadier wanted to know why no one in the Durhams had qualified on the Bren gun, until he was told the Bren gun wasn't a Bren gun, but it was a Lewis gun. And that was the, you know, and at the same time, they were talking about boys' anti-tank rifles. We didn't know what a one was. We'd never seen a Bren gun, we'd never seen a boys' anti-tank rifle. And I carried a piece of metal and wood weighted to the weight of a boys' anti-tank rifle on Southern Command's manoeuvres. And when I was supposed to be firing a boys' anti-tank rifle, I had a piece of metal and wood. And that was 1938, the year before war. So you can understand, when the press was saying we were the best equipped army in the world, we were regular soldiers, knew we weren't.
Well, perhaps we can come to that
later on
in detail.
Aye, but
in
that,
later.
But yeah, that was true. That was fact.
Okay. You mentioned a couple of other things that you learned to do in your training at Kattery. One was field signals. What do you use for the
hand signals and whistles? You know, if you wanted to wanted the any troops or sections to move to the right, you'd put your right hand out and move. And if you want them to double, you'd move the hands quick. If you just want
them, was an up and down movement.
Up and down movement with the hand and or the left hand. If you want them to close in, you put both hands on your head. If you want them to double, you know.
You hit the top of the head with both hands.
Both hands, quick. You would have a tin helmet on, right? Tin hat on, and you'd, you know, no camouflage, but a bright tin hat. And whistling.
So these were ways to get men to move who were out of
sight. Yeah. You know, well out of sight. Well out of hearing. Instead of shouting, and then at night time you'd have whistles. I forget the whistle calls now, but you used to have whistle calls in the night, in the dark, and you know you'd be told you were going to make an attack at a certain time, and you would get the blow, and the officer would just maybe blow too short to see advance and want to stop or something like that. I forget what the signals was now, but yes, that happened.
Did you have any other weapons training? For example, were you familiarised with gas at this time?
We were trained with tear gas to represent the poisonous gases which had been used by the Germans in the First World War. We would go into a gas chamber with our respirators on, and then after a period of time we would be told to take them off, and then the tear gas would get really into your eyes and make you cry, and then you would be told to go out after you'd been in a while. And you had this once or twice, but your high stung, you knew you'd been in a tear gas situation when you'd had it.
Did you have any other training there with gas masks? Did you ever have to wear them as a matter of
course? Oh yes, you might have done some exercises and wear them for a night or so. But I don't think, although you had the equipment, I don't think there was serious, really serious training with them. They would give you elementary training, but I don't think there was any serious training. Just like the gas chamber, you go in for tear gas once in a while, but really gas training didn't take place until the war started, the Second World War started.
Did you have any training using grenades?
Not at Catrick, I cannot recall at all. I may have seen one, but I still cannot recall it.
Did you have any special skill training?
Not at Catrick, just the ordinary squad training, infantry, section and platoon and unit training, you know, the ordinary soldiers training.
Can I ask if your accommodation at Catrick was any different to that you'd had at Newcastle?
Yes, I think so. The first thing was they were rather single-storey high bungalows, interconnected with the next platoon. Two platoons would be connected together to use the same toilets and ablutions. You know, like two down and one across.
Yes.
That way. And then they went strict with the cleaning of the barracks. More soldierly, I think you'd say that. You know, you did keep them clean. Don't misunderstand me when I say they weren't as strict. Cleanliness next to godliness at the depot, where soldiering was the next best thing at Catrick. You'd cleaned your windows, you cleaned your walls, you did your beds and everything else. But you didn't use as much polish on the floors as you did at the depot. You kept them clean, but you didn't use as much. And discipline was definitely much laxer. You were living better, let's put it that way. You made new, when you came from the depot, where you were a squad formed into one from recruits and civilians, you went amongst trained soldiers, and it was a different atmosphere altogether. It was a more relaxed atmosphere, more helpful to each other, I should think. It was difficult to say it, but I think when you went to a battalion and into a platoon, it was completely different from recruit training. It must be in every service, the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force or the Army, it must be different from recruit training to going to a trained unit. Yes, I think it must be. And I felt much easier, where you didn't have to ask an NCO if you could go to the canteen. Once your day's work was finished, other than being warned that you were either on guard duty or on fatigues, you could go anywhere within the garrison without asking the corporal or a lance corporal if you could go out of the room. But at the depot, you had to ask. That was the main difference. You're more humanised when you got to the battalion.
What about leaving the camp? Was Catrick itself a town that you could go to?
It was a military camp. It wasn't a civilian camp, but there was a cinema near our barracks, so if there was a good picture on, you could all get there first, let's put it that way. And there was a swimming bath at the Sandys soldiers' home. If you wanted a weekend off, you could go and book at the Sandys soldiers' home. Say you didn't want to be in barracks, say you just wanted to get out of barracks, you could go, you could apply for a weekend pass, and you could stop at the soldiers' home for a modest fee.
Did you go there yourself?
I didn't go I went into the home daily or on odd occasions, but I didn't go for a rest. I used the swimming baths, yes. I used the swimming baths in the Sandys home.
Was there a town nearby that you could go into if you...
Well, there was Richmond, which was more or less attached or just detached from Catrick Garrison, with Catrick Garrison being a military establishment. There was only more or less maybe a field and the railway line between the garrison and the town of Richmond.
Did you go to Richmond often?
No, I think if I went in once or twice at the time I was there. But again, you say, when you say, did you go in? Time was the thing. Because from leaving the depot and getting to Kattrick and having to go through all the training, which we had, there was many a time you didn't feel like leaving camp. And of course, there was a cinema quite close to our barracks where you could go in. They changed the pictures twice a week. Or you could go into the canteen, and there was a recreation room where you could go and play billiards, or there was a library or a reading room where you could read the day's papers or get a library and read it. So sometimes you were too tired, or sometimes you didn't have any money, so you didn't go out. It just depends. And with the training, as I say, you started early in the year, and it went on till the early autumn. And then you maybe get a leave and come back, and then you would start other kind of work. But I was never at Kattrick for to do that, because by that time came, I was on draft for India.
Can I ask you about your leave? Did you actually have leave while you were at Kattrick? Were you able to get home?
I think I got home about twice, but I wouldn't be certain. But then I got me embarkation leave, which was about 2 months, because once you went abroad, you were not entitled to home leave till after you'd done 6 years service overseas. So the army used to give you 56 days leave, and it was the same when you came back. If you came back and you had more service to do, you immediately, as soon as it was possible, they gave you 56 days leave. Example, when we came back from the Sudan, well, we arrived in Southampton on the morning. We travelled up through Southampton to Woking Station. We came from Woking Station to Knapp Hill Barracks, and I was on a train at night coming home. I was in Durham before midnight on the same day. That's how quickly they got you away. As you'd been overseas so many years, they give you 56 days leave straight away, no argument. Everything was done for you. It was very quick.
Can you tell me about this posting then that you got? When did you first hear about this overseas posting?
All your names just came on battalion orders. Numbers, ranks, names. All ranks, didn't matter what the rank was. Depending on what the overseas battalion wanted. Reinforcing, depending on how many of their men were time expired or men due to come home after 6 years. Officers or men, all ranks, it applied to everybody. And if there was 200 coming from the overseas battalion, the home battalion would have to try and supply 200 reinforcements.
And So when did you first hear that you were being posted overseas?
Maybe August.
What year would that be?
1933, August, September 1933. Your name just came on orders. The roles of them, you know, numbers, ranks and names. These men will proceed for draft. Forewarned for draft into India to join the 2nd Battalion. This will happen on such and such a date. You will be inoculated. You'll be vaccinated. If you hadn't been vaccinated, you'd be not, and then TAB and what have you, all the necessary medical precautions would be done. Then these men will proceed on leave at such and such a date for so many days, and all this would be promulgated in unit orders signed by the CO.
What did you feel about the knowledge that you were now going overseas?
Well, we'd heard so much from the NCO, senior NCOs, or old soldiers who would come back. We'd heard, you know, when you went to the canteen, you would hear these lads talking about what they'd done, what they hadn't done, and you'd sometimes, if you saw a sergeant, you'd say, "Where have you been?" You know, they used to talk about when you had breaks. You'd say, "Anybody like to ask any questions when you were training?" Things like that. And have you been abroad? Well, they used to call India Ponky Land, because you could smell it a long way off in the Indian Ocean before you got to the land. The land smell was there. And the nickname for it in our battalion was Ponky Land. And they used to say it to the sergeants, however, "Have you been to Ponky Land? What was it like?" And they would reel off tales of what had happened when they were out. And of course, I wouldn't mind being out there. And when the drafting came, you accepted it. You didn't say it was wrong. cannot remember of anybody. I think what they were looking forward to, they read the old stories of the Northwest Frontier and things like that. They'd heard about these expeditions and forages and what have you. And I think it was some kind of an expectation of a further education in military life, if you like, further education in the service.
Were you excited when you saw your name up there? Were you looking forward to going?
I cannot say I was excited, except that I had got so used to accepting army orders then that I just accepted it was just another part of my life in the service. I had not intended from the day I enlisted to take promotion. That may sound strange. I had gone in with a purpose to serve 7 years and to come out, and that's what I did. I can prove that later on, but in another session.
Why have you decided not to go for promotion?
Just because I didn't want to make the service a career. And I thought I would, maybe if I went in for promotion, I would do somebody else out of a promotion who would be more welcome than I was. I had a single mind. When I gone in to join the army, I had gone in with one single thought, and that was to do 7 years, try and learn something and come out. Well, your mind gets changed while you are soldiering in the infantry. Now, from time to time, a notice would be published in unit orders. Volunteers are wanted to go to the veterinary corps. Men are wanted to go into this formation or that formation, and you applied for these vacancies, but you never got them. And when you made inquiries in a roundabout way, in the usual grapevine way, why didn't this happen? You'd be told that all applications have been thrown into the wastebasket at the orderly room. It got as far as the adjutant and he'd throw them into the waste bin. You'll never be able to prove that.
Why would he have done that?
Because they didn't want to lose men from the regiment. I could think prove that in other ways later on. But once you were in a regiment, unless you had done something severely wrong and they wanted to get rid of you, say you weren't a good soldier and they wanted to get rid of you, they'd let you go. But if you were the normal average soldier, you were there forever until, unless you got your first class certificate of education, there was no way you'd get out of the infantry or out of the regiment.
Do you think that was wrong?
Yes, because I think, again, I can prove it later on during the war again, not that it may